Monica McFaughn is a writer and playwright from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Monica's new story collection, Bright Shards of Someplace Else, won the 2013 Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction. It was published this year by University of Georgia Press. Monica teaches writing at Grand Valley State University and trains her Welsh Cob cross pony in dressage and jumping. Welcome, Monica, and congratulations on this award-winning book. Tell us about this story collection.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Well, it's 11 short stories, and they're not linked, so they're quite different from each other. One of the challenges of describing the book was how to sort of give an overall impression of it. So basically, in each story, there's characters that don't quite understand the other's perspective. And so it's all about sort of the missed connections and people sort of assuming that they understand something that they clearly don't. But the characters really range. So there's a poetry professors, there's a nanny, there's little kids, there's a couple stories about horses and horse trainers, there's veterinarians, there's a singer-songwriter pair at the end. Many of the characters in the book are makers or artists of some type, so even a horse trainer can sort of be put in that category. So that's kind of the major overall description of it.
Okay. The first thing I noticed when I was reading your story collection was, of course, your incredible talent. You're a wonderful writer. The second thing that came to me, somewhere about halfway through the book, I'm reading these stories and I'm realizing I'm not seeing dialogue, at least not in the way that I usually do when I'm reading prose. And you're a playwright, so that really struck me as interesting.
Well, it's funny that you say that because I didn't notice that about the stories. And then after I looked at them, you're right, there's not a lot of dialogue. And if there is dialogue, there's not a lot of back and forth volleying.
Right.
Which is strange because I am a playwright and I've also written a screenplay, so I'm used to writing or relying on dialogue to move the plot along.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason that I don't have a lot of dialogue is one of the things I'm interested in is the contrast between people's thoughts and what they say. And if you think about how much you speak in relationship to how much you think, the thoughts are, a much larger part of your life experience. And what you say is very minor and sometimes in contrast to what you're thinking. So I think what I was trying to show is when somebody speaks, they're only saying like the tip of what they're thinking, and sometimes they're not even representing it accurately.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because even if you're having a conversation, your mind can be racing, and I think the majority of conversations I have are in my head. And that's not because I'm an antisocial person, but because you spend so much time imagining what you would say or thinking about other people's reactions or analyzing what's been said.
Right.
And so little time relatively actually talking to the amount that you think. So I think I was trying to show that kind of nature of reality where you're way more in your head than you are outward, even if you're the most outgoing person.
Hmm. That's interesting. So when you have a seed of an idea, because you write fiction, because you write poetry too, I understand, and plays, when you get that seed of an idea, how do you know which way to go?
Well, that's tough because usually when I get a seed of an idea, I try that idea and usually it ends up going a different direction. So I usually, many of those stories in the collection are really different than what they first started as. So, for instance, one of the stories is about a mathematician who works at a butterfly release company, and he solves a famous proof, and then he's kind of waylaid before he can tell his discovery to the world. When I originally started writing that story, I was really interested in the butterfly release business, because somebody had once said to me, oh, I know somebody who has a business where, you know, they release butterflies at funerals and, weddings and things, and he just, and all this person said was the business had a lot of problems. And for some reason, that struck me as sort of interesting because it seems like such a happy thing, releasing butterflies,
yeah.
Butterflies are pretty. And he said it so ominously.
Yeah.
And I didn't ask follow-up questions because I thought, well, that's fascinating. I wonder what those problems were. So when I started writing that story, it was called The Troubles with Final Release. So Final Release was the fictional name of the company. And I started to write about, this company's problems with accidentally killing butterflies and things. And it was, not that great a story. I mean, it was just somebody's small business kind of floundering. And I don't know how the mathematician came in. I think the mathematician was sort of a different idea that I'd been thinking about for a while. I'd been thinking about trying to write about math. you know, as somebody who doesn't like math, doesn't, you know, understand it very well, I wanted to kind of inhabit a person that was passionate for it. And so eventually what I did is, you know, the final release butterfly story wasn't going anywhere. So I thought, well, let's see if we could bring the mathematician into it. And that's how I ended up with that story. But yeah, usually the first seed is like the thing that you cut off as you keep writing. It's a little bit, not sure what a good comparison would be to that, but it's like that starter, and then mm-hmm. eventually you don't need it anymore.
Has one ever turned into to another? Say you're writing a story and it's like, well, wait a minute, this should be a play, or you finish the story and you also write a play of the story?
Usually, like, for example, the screenplay that I've been working on is a lot more comedic, and so normally I don't look at my stories and think, well, they could work. And I think part of it maybe is the lack of dialogue. The stories, I think, are really interior. Mm. They're a lot about people's consciousness as they move through various problems and predicaments. So there's not usually a situation where I say, well, that's not going to work for a story, maybe a play. But sometimes, though, like the last story, I think that could work as a play. In fact, one of the things that I'm doing to promote the book is in November 20th in New York City, we're going to do what's called a live book trailer. My friend Christopher Stevens and some actors, where we pick sort of pivotal scenes from the stories and do a medley of different scenes for the audience. Mm. So it's like a trailer. So it's like a movie trailer, or like those filmed book trailers you see online, but it's live.
Oh,
so
neat.
So that was an interesting challenge, especially when you talk about the dialogue thing, to figure out what portions of it am I going to use for that. And some it came really easily, and some it was kind of tough. So so that's been a really interesting process to try to figure out, can you do that with this kind of interior literary fiction?
Yeah. Now, your characters are exceptionally quirky and intriguing. And the very first story, Out of the Mouths of Babes, there's this child, this precocious child, who is able to get on the phone and solve all kinds of problems that most of us adults, I think, spend hours trying to solve. How do you come up with these characters? Are they usually based on real people in your life? Or?
Well, that's an interesting question. That particular character wasn't based on anybody in real life. At that time, I was for some reason getting on, you know, random blogs online, and I found a bunch of blogs of parents talking about their incredibly gifted children. And there was like a parent's blog, like My Gifted Kids, and it was all about the struggle of her genius children and how she couldn't find schools that could adequately challenge them. And it just struck me as the most absurd thing. Like, sure, maybe the kids are smart, but the way she was going on and on. So at first I was thinking, well, I want to write about, you know, like a parent that has this sense that their children are gifted. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. And kind of this world of gifted children. Of course, that's not where the story goes. We don't really hear about his world, and it doesn't seem like his parents maybe even are comfortable with his brilliance.
Right.
But I liked the idea of a child that could speak like an adult, that could be so articulate that he could almost pass for an adult, and he's almost this like parrot that sounds like an adult but obviously isn't, you know, fully formed or fully developed, and how that person could wreak havoc in the adult world, especially if he ends up being babysat by a sort of troubled, somewhat alcoholic nanny who has a lot of personality issues. So putting those two characters together was just a way for me to think about what it would be like to be that kind of child. Because I think there's been times in my own life where, I mean, and it sounds a little strange to say, but when I was younger, sometimes I would purposely say things to make myself sound less articulate, because I felt like a certain like smoothness in speech seemed strange. And I always remember that. And so when I think about this kid, I think, wow, you know, here's somebody who's embracing it, who's like, you know, I can speak in this perfect way, and I've sort of figured out the code of adulthood.
You were a precocious child, weren't you?
Well, I don't know if I was or not, but I remember thinking, I don't want to use that word, or I don't want to use that combination of words because it sounds too smooth. I'll pretend like I'm trying to think of the words. So I would add like an artificial pause in what I was saying. It was just kind of a strange, you know, quirk, probably more, you know, my own imagination than anything else.
So winning the Flannery O'Connor Award for this, did that change your writing career? Did it give it a shot of adrenaline? What did that do for your writing career?
Well, it's a hugely dramatic thing to win. for me, at my stage of my career and at my stage of writing fiction, because I have a poetry MFA from Western, actually. And I didn't even start writing fiction until 2007, 2008. And I really used the Flannery O'Connor deadline just to get a first draft of a collection out. So it was just a deadline to finish a manuscript collection. And so I was writing those stories like up until the very last minute. So when I submitted it, I had no idea that I would win. I just thought this is the beginning of the trying to get this book of short stories published. And I thought I'd have an uphill battle because of how, you know, disparate it is. Because you see a lot of short story collections that are, you know, linked stories, or it's all, you know, they're all set in like a water park in Minnesota, you know, and there's like 10 of them. And that's not interesting to me. I like, you know, kind of making readers sort of like leave one story and go to another story that's completely a different world.
So a novel in stories is not appealing to you?
No. I mean, okay. I think if I wrote a novel, maybe I would do it that way. But in terms of like a pure short story book, you know, this is the type that I enjoy reading and enjoy writing. So when I won the award, it was, and it still is, I mean, I'm still in the process of it, a huge shock. And it really has accelerated my writing career because now the project's done. I was thinking I would have to spend years polishing it, years sending it to people. And so now I'm suddenly thrust into like a whole different stage. So that's been really exciting because now I feel like it's going to be easier to do the next thing. So I'm interested in writing a novel. I've written a screenplay. And, you know, at the time when I find writing really hard. And at the time when I thought to myself, I thought, well, if I get a book published, I'll take a lot of time off. And maybe I, you know, will just retire on one book. But I don't think that's going to happen. But that was part of what helped me get through it. I'm like, well, if you just get through it, you cannot write short stories ever again. But that probably isn't going to happen. It's probably the opposite effect.
We hope not. So you are planning a novel?
Yeah, I'm planning a novel. And I'm pretty excited about it because it involves quite a bit of research. And, you know, one of the, I think the themes of the short story book and maybe just a theme of my life is obsession. So, you know, I ride dressage and I'm, you know, very obsessed with my horse, with training my horse. I'm completely annoying when I talk about it because people just glaze over. I get into these super minute details. And my boyfriend, who's an artist, he's a sculptor and works in like a cabinet maker. He gets Wooden Boat magazine. And so people who have wooden boats are incredibly obsessive about the purity of what they're doing. So they try to sail these boats without engines, and they try to use only kind of processes with the boats that are true to their original kind of veneers and things. And so my idea for the novel is to have a couple who sails this boat around the world. And there's a real couple that's done this, one of these kind of handmade wooden boats, gets into marital trouble and brings a mediator on board to help him out. So I like the idea of like entering into a person, like a long-term relationship and being a third party sort of looking at this sort of bizarre dynamic of these people who have built a life out of kind of a nomadic, exotic, and obsessive lifestyle.
Well, you touched on your horse. How does riding a horse help you become a better writer?
Well, I think in so many ways, and I think one of the main ways is when you ride dressage, you're basically, it's considered horse ballet, and you're trying to ask the horse to do these movements that they do in Liberty in a very organized way. And people who train dressage, it takes a horse, even for the best trainers, about a decade to get to the highest level of dressage. And those are people that are professionals and have all the support in the world. So for amateurs like me, who, you know, can't commit to it full time and I don't have just boatloads of money to throw at it, you're constantly just trying to improve. And you start at such a low level and you know in your lifetime you're never probably going to hit the highest level. So you, and the process of riding dressage is more important than the product. So you can create a horse that looks like it's beautifully moving, that looks like a dressage horse, but if that was created using methods that were harsh or coercive, sometimes you can use gadgets that kind of tie their head down and force them into a certain kind of movement. That's considered against the spirit of dressage, which is training in a very systematic way in harmony with the horse. So I think because of that, when I write, I try to think of my writing that way. Rather than always thinking of it as, I need to get this story done, I think, what kind of writing can I do to build up my ability to do other writing? Or where's the hole in my training, I sort of think of it. Because when you ride dressage, if you skip a step in training, it'll show up at a later level. So let's say your horse isn't like really soft in his neck and he holds tension in his neck and you don't work on that, but yet he shows a brilliant movement. Eventually that lack of a sort of suppleness will come in and sort of ruin what you're doing. So you're constantly having to go back to basics in dressage. And so I think in writing, you have to do the same thing. So I sometimes feel like my structures aren't, well built enough. And so I constantly go back to working on structure. I constantly go back to working on characters. And I think that that willingness to go back to basics and to really just try to build myself as a writer very slowly and deliberately, rather than saying, well, now's the time when I should write a novel. I should write X novel because it might get me famous. It's more like, what's the novel that's going to take my my writing personally to the next level? Mm. Whether that novel would be interesting to other people, maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't, but it would at least move me forward. And I think that helps because you do so much writing as a writer that's not going to see the light of day. But if you know that it's contributing to your overall abilities, you know, you can sort of take heart and be inspired by that.
And what's this I hear about you working on a board game of the publishing process?
Yeah, I haven't done that. I mean, that was one of the things that I told myself I was going to do after I got this book published. But, you know, my dad's really into making board games, and I'm sort of fascinated with games.
Yeah.
There are some very interesting board games, and just what they make your mind do mentally, it's just fascinating. And there can be all these variables, so one of the things that I always describe to students when I describe the publishing process is publishing is like you're in a giant board game and your only goal is to move forward a square. Now, you will see people around you all over the place that hit a bonus square, you know, kind of like chutes and ladders, that zooms them to a published work. But that's not common. So all you have to do is tell yourself, I'm just getting to the next square. And if you keep just getting to the next square, you'll eventually get something published. But people get impatient because they see, you know, this sort of famous person here, this, you know, person that graduated with them getting like a huge book deal. And in reality, look at the square you're on and go to the next square. So I thought it would be interesting to kind of create a board game sort of around that sort of metaphor that I use. And then also have different, different players. Like one could be an editor, one could be an agent, one could be a writer. And the writer could have, you know, certain problems. So they would draw cards. So they could be, you know, neurotic, or they could have, you know, like...
Well, that's a given.
Right. Well, that would be a card that everybody got for sure. Or they could have like, you know, sudden brilliance, or they could be really unreliable. So, you know, they get a book deal and then, you know, maybe they get a card where it's like you go on a bender for 3 weeks and nobody can get a hold of you, you know, and that's part of, you know, how writers can fall off the rails. But I think it's interesting just because... there's so much luck, but then there's also so much you're given. So you come, you know, to the game with a stack of cards, and it's really about how you play it, and that's what I think would be interesting to do. So I do plan on doing that at some point, but I've not yet really started.
No, I'll watch for that. Now, you've been teaching at GVSU since 2009. Mm-hmm. Do you take your own advice, the writing advice that you give to your students?
Well, I try to. You know, I'm somebody who finds writing hard. I mean, I'm not one of those people who sit down and say that the muse is with me and the characters just flow and they're speaking and I'm like, wow, the character said that. No, I feel like everything that I write is kind of difficult and comes out of a very difficult place. So I try to create things for my students that help them get out of whatever locked position that they're in. So I do try to take my own advice. For instance, I have them spin a wheel. So I am into games in my teaching too, where they spin a wheel and then they have to take a risk with their story. So whatever they don't like writing about, they have to throw that into their work, and it's determined by, you know, what they get on this wheel. So for instance, you know, I don't particularly like stories that are at first I didn't really like stories that were real traditional. Like the first story in my collection is a very straightforward narrative. It's not experimental in any way. It's told in real time. I thought, oh, those look hard to write, and I'm not sure I always like stories that are like that. And so I kind of like spun the wheel in my own head. I said, well, that means you need to try it. Because I think the very things that you sort of gravitate away from and say, oh, I don't like that, I don't like that, those are the things you have to make yourself do. Because probably the reason you're saying you don't like it is because there's something daunting about it, or you're not seeing its possibilities. So I do try to use some of my own tricks, and part of the reason I thought of the tricks is they're tricks that I've used for myself.
Okay. Now, you've said before in another interview, my stories are broadly about how people love, fear, and are moved by their own misreadings of other people, not the people themselves. Explain that.
Well, I think that this is true for anybody who's ever been fascinated by another person, certainly anybody who's been in love. You know, when you see people in the world or you meet people, especially people that intrigue you, you create this whole mythology around them where you attribute feelings to them. Sometimes you think you know their inner thoughts. You sort of feel like, well, I know what it would be like to be that person. They have this certain sensibility. I have that sensibility too. We're two sort of people sort of split off from the rest of the world. In reality, you don't know what their mind is like. And I think that's one of the most fascinating things about writing and just about living in the world is how alien any other person's mental state is and just the way that their mind is. Like, what does it sound like in their mind? You know, what is the tone of their thoughts? You know, so I think when you are in love with somebody or just fascinated by them, because those things can be close together, it may not be somebody you're romantically attracted to, but just somebody who's intriguing, you're creating a character that you are interacting with, falling in love with, falling out of love with, becoming obsessed with, you know, rejecting or whatever the pattern may be. But that actual person is sovereign from that. They're not really that thing that you think they are. And I think that's sort of the fascinating and kind of tragic thing about all relationships.
Hmm. Do you prefer 19th century writers to contemporary? I understand that you like 19th century more.
Well, I don't like 19th century more, but I am a huge fan of Nathaniel Hawthorne, and he's been a huge influence on me. And it's not the type of writer that most contemporary writers reference. And I always feel sort of strange, like, people give me a funny look when I say I love Hawthorne because they think of him as the writer they were forced to read in high school and, you know, Hester with her A. But one of the things I do like about 19th century writers and Hawthorne in particular is that the stories had a really crisp ending. And I think some contemporary fiction sort of either trails off or ends on an image or sort of an epiphany that feels a little familiar. So I like contemporary fiction. There's a lot of fiction that, you know, does end in this sort of crisp way. But you can sort of guarantee when you read a Hawthorne short story that it's going to be buttoned up at the end. And some people think that's kind of artificial. You know, life flows. We shouldn't end our stories with sort of a snap. But I like that because I like that kind of giving that last little bit of polish and that last little bit of shape. So that's one of the things that drew me to Hawthorne. And I think that is something in my collection that, you know, there are a few things from reading Hawthorne that I think make my collection sort of harken back to the 19th century. And some of the endings, I think, do that. Not all of them, but I think there are a few that I hope are Hawthorne-esque. I mean, you know, at least I'll claim they are.
So you have a reading coming up at Michigan News Agency. What can people expect? Will you be reading one of the stories from the book? And when is this reading?
It's September 11th. I'll be reading from the collection. There'll be a Q&A. And I'll answer any questions that people have. So sometimes people can ask about the publishing process. They can ask about the particular story, questions like you're asking me today. So there'll be a little bit of time to hang out and talk. And of course, I'll also be signing books there.
All right. And could you read us an excerpt, Monica? We'd love to hear a little bit of your writing style.
Okay. So I'm going to read the beginning of a story called The Chautauqua Sessions. And the thing to know before I started is the speaker is a man. So I'm not a man, but and I'll just say it in my regular voice. My son, the drug addict, is about to tell a story. I can tell because he's closed his eyes and lifted his chin. I can tell because he's laid his hands, palms down on the table, like a shaman feeling the energy of the tree spirit still in the wood. I can tell because he's drawing a shuddering breath, as if what he has to say will take all he's got. He's putting on the full show because he has a new audience. He'd streamline the theatrics if it were only me. We're having dinner at Levi Lambright's recording compound, Chautauqua, in remote Appalachian Tennessee. I'm a songwriter, a lyricist, and I'm here to work on a new album with Levi, our first in 15 years. Dee was not invited. The only other person who should be here is Lucinda, Levi's cook. But Dee just showed up the way drug-addicted sons sometimes do. Right as he's about to speak, I reach from the wine bottle and refill my glass, placing the bottle back down in front of me, providing a bit of visual shield between us. He's sitting across from me next to Levi. The kid looks good, I'll give him that. He's clean-shaven, and his dun-colored hair appears professionally cut. His eyes, where the cresting chaos can most often be seen, are clear and still. They still don't track exactly right, though. Like his mother, he looks at you out of one eye at a time like a quizzical parrot. If you look at him straight on, his thin face seems to wobble and shake like a coin on end before it flips back into profile, his mother's aquiline nose and sharp chin etched in the center of his round boy's head. On his forearm, his old self-mutilation scars have been scribbled over, I see, with a new homemade tattoo. Trust. I don't see myself in him at all.
Thank you, Monica. Enjoyed talking with you.
All right. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.